Okay, well, good evening once again. This is Richard Clem. Today is November 30th, 2017, and we are doing tonight part two of Iowa trust accounts, a CLE look at the trust account rules governing attorneys in Iowa specifically. However, much of the material that we're going to be talking about tonight is equally relevant to attorneys in other states. In part one of the program, in fact, I think it's safe to say that everything I said in the first 45 minutes of the program is really applicable to attorneys in just about any state, because what we were looking at then was Rule 1.15 of the Iowa Rules of Professional Conduct. Well, those are identical to the Rules of Professional Conduct in Minnesota and many, many other states. So everything we covered last night was pretty much applicable to attorneys just about anywhere. And tonight on our live program, I see we have quite a few Minnesota attorneys. So the information we're going to be covering tonight is Iowa-specific. However, the same general principles apply. And I will direct your attention to, let's see if I can find it. Yeah, specifically, if you're a Minnesota attorney and you want to consult those the Minnesota rules, well, if you go to the main webpage of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, just Google, you know, Minnesota Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board will be the quickest way to find it. And on their webpage, there's a link that you can click on that says Trust Accounts. And there are two specific documents that you will find there. First of all, there's they have a guide entitled Operating Lawyer Trust Accounts, which is a good background of the information that you need to know about it. And specifically, in Minnesota, you will want to consult a document entitled Appendix 1 to the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. I think last night I called it Appendix A, but the official title is Appendix 1. And that's actually incorporated by reference into the Minnesota rules, and it is binding, and it covers probably with some slight differences, but it probably covers essentially the same material that we're going to be covering tonight, because in Minnesota it is called Appendix 1 to the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. Well, in Iowa, that guidance that we're going to be going into detail tonight is called Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules. And also Chapter 39 of the Iowa Court Rules. But whether it's Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules or if it's Appendix 1 of the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct, you'll find that those requirements are pretty much the same. And specifically, Chapter 45 and that Appendix 1 talk specifically about the nuts and bolts of what you have to do with respect to your attorney trust account. And Rule 45.1 starts by saying that any time a lawyer receives clients from money from clients or a third party arising out of the practice of law, pretty much the same language echoed from Rule 1.15, it says that money shall be deposited into your trust account. But here it goes into a little bit more detail. It says it has to be an identifiable interest-bearing trust account, and we'll talk about that interest-bearing requirement later in the program. And it says it has to be a trust account located in Iowa, and most other states will have a similar rule, saying that the trust account has to have its locus in that state. So if you are in Iowa and you have a trust account at a bank in Minnesota, well, that does not comply. Similarly, if you're in Minnesota, I think the rule probably says that that it has to be located at a Minnesota bank. So that probably not a big deal for most attorneys, but if you are involved in any kind of a practice that crosses state lines, well, that is one thing that you have to keep in mind. And if you look closely at the two conflicting rules, at the two rules in the two states governing you, well, they probably both say that it has to be in an account located in that particular state. It certainly says that for Iowa. So you have to be careful if you do practice in more than one state. It might require you having a trust account in each state where you practice law. Although, before you rush out in a panic to open that new account, I would look at the very last rule of professional conduct, which I think is Rule 8.8, which covers the choice of law provisions. And it says if you principally practice in one state, well, then kind of by default, you have to follow the rules of that state. But it also says that if conduct has its predominant impact in some other state, well, then you might be bound by that state's rules as well. So if you have, if you have a practice that takes place in both Minnesota and Iowa, you have some transactions that have their predominant effect in Minnesota, well, perhaps those have to be in a Minnesota trust account, whereas the clients in Iowa, where it has its predominant impact in the state of Iowa, you would have to have a separate trust account in that state. So that's one thing to watch out for if you have a practice across the state lines. For those like me who are admitted only in one state, I don't have to worry about that too much. But if you are admitted or practice across state lines in any way, you might have to watch out for that. The other requirement about your trust account imposed by this rule is mostly what we're talking about right now is your pooled trust account, the trust account where you deposit all clients' funds, no matter where they come from. We'll talk a little bit later on whether you might need a separate trust account in some particular case. In either event, one requirement imposed by this rule is that that trust account shall be clearly designated as trust account. And the rule puts quotation marks around the words trust account. It says it has to be clearly designated as, quote, trust account. Now, Iowa and Minnesota don't go into great detail on exactly what that phrase means, you might, if you want to exercise an overabundance of caution, well, then what you might want to do is follow the very specific requirements of the Wisconsin rule that gives a little bit more definition to that phrase, because that Wisconsin rule, and this is not the literal rule in Iowa, but the Wisconsin rule says that everything connected with that account, such as the signature card, such as the checkbook, such as the bank statement, has to have the words trust account, those exact words, not abbreviated in any fashion. The word trust account has to appear on all of those things someplace. Now, at one point here in Minnesota, my bank was sending me the bank statement for my trust account that would put me in violation of that Wisconsin provision because my bank used an abbreviation. My trust account bank statement came addressed to MNLTAB, LTAB, and the TA in there stood for trust account, but it was an abbreviation. It stood for Minnesota Lawyers Trust Account Board. That actually has been rectified since then, but that would not be in compliance with that Wisconsin rule, and perhaps it would not be in compliance with this Iowa rule because it's not clearly designated as, quote, trust account. It's kind of unclearly designated as MNLTAB. That's one thing you want to watch out for, and I guess your homework for this evening that I will assign is to go take a look at all the paraphernalia about your trust account, such as your checkbook. Well, you can probably go look at the checkbook, and I'm sure you have the words trust account printed prominently on the actual checks. What about the bank statement, though? Is the address on the bank statement, is the title of the account, does it include the words trust account, or does it include some kind of an abbreviation? And if it does include some kind of an abbreviation, even if you're not in Wisconsin where it says no abbreviations, that might be something that you could rectify so easily just by calling up the bank and saying, can you put the words trust account, not abbreviated, on this statement? so that if it's always clear that this is a trust account, and somebody such as the executor of your estate, because we were talking last night a little bit about the succession provisions. Well, somebody if the successor of your estate sees this bank statement and just says LTAB and they don't know what LTAB stands for, well, they could potentially mishandle it. Whereas if they get this bank statement and they have the words trust account written prominently up there, that would leave a lot less guesswork. So now are you required to have a trust account in the first place? Well, no, the rules never say that you are required to have a trust account just because of your status as an attorney. That's not what the rule says. What the rule says is any time you do receive money from a client or third party in the course of the practice of law, it has to be deposited into a trust account. So if you are in the private practice of law and you are confident that you are never, ever, ever going to handle funds belonging to somebody else, well, then you don't have to worry about it. But on the other hand, there are so many situations where you might need that trust account for some reason. Because, even if you just practice law on a, extremely part-time basis, and you, as a part of that part-time practice of law, you come into the possession of money belonging to a client or a third party, well, you need some place to put it. And if that happens on a Sunday when the bank is closed, well, where do you put it? So it's even though the rule does not say, all lawyers in the state of Iowa must have a trust account, well, that would kind of be a good default provision. So if there's ever any potential for that happening. And as we will see later in the program, for example, pretty much any time you get money before you've done the work, well, that's a transaction that's going to involve your trust account. So if you're... again, if you practice law and you're confident you're never going to handle client funds and you're also comfortable with never getting paid in advance, well, then you don't need a trust account. But it could come up so often that it's probably worthwhile going down to talk to your bank and opening up a trust account, even if you're only tangentially involved in the practice of law, or if your practice only rarely requires you to handle client funds. Money belonging to the client always goes in the trust account. That's what Rule 45.1 says. Rule 45.1 also says, and I think we went into this in pretty great detail in the first part of the program, that money belonging to you never goes in your trust account. And again, there are two exceptions to that. One is money belonging partly to a client and partly to you, such as a settlement in an injury case or something, and also money sufficient to cover monthly service charges. But here the rule goes into a little bit more detail and says the allowable monthly service charges. Probably $100 is a good safe harbor number for that. And at this point, I'm going to give our first code number of the evening, and that will be E-225. E-225. E is in ethics, 225 is our first code number that you'll need to email me at the end of the program. Either if you're taking it live or if you're taking it as part of the podcast, so that I can record your attendance. The rule, like I say, goes into a little bit more detail about that money belonging jointly to you and the client. And the rule here says that when that money belonging jointly to you and the client is deposited into the trust account, the money should be remitted promptly to the client. That kind of goes without saying. This rule also says that you may disburse the money once it is earned by you. Even though this rule uses the word may, I think it's safe to say that we could substitute the word shall in there. because once that money is earned, well, then it's no longer money belonging jointly to you and the client, and it should be dispersed promptly because it no longer fits within the exception. So once funds are earned, this rule says that they may be dispersed to you, but really, I think the rule should say shall, because otherwise it's a case of commingling. Rule 45.2 starts to talk about the record keeping requirements, and before it goes into the record keeping requirements, Rule 45.2 parentheses 1 makes clear that any transactions involving your trust account that require your client's signature, such as the endorsement on the back of the check, you do not have implied authority to sign on behalf of your client for transactions that have anything to do with your trust account. Now, in many cases, the attorney-client relationship presupposes that you have authority to sign things on behalf of your client. That's why they hired you, so that you can do things on their behalf. You sign the complaint that you're filing for their lawsuit. You sign that on their behalf. They don't have to, in most cases, personally sign that because you're signing on their behalf as their attorney. And that's normally what we do as attorneys. But you are not allowed to do that regarding transactions to your trust account, unless in I think would be a very rare situation, unless you are specifically authorized. So in other words, you don't have an implied authority to sign the settlement check on behalf of your client, but there could be express authority given. That would probably be pretty rare that express authority would take place, because it seems to me I would be uncomfortable having that express authority not be in writing, and if they are going to sign the writing giving you express authority to sign on their behalf, if they have to come in to sign that, why don't they just sign the back of the check? It would make a lot less work for everybody. So I think it's safe to say it would be a pretty rare situation where you would sign an endorsement on behalf of a client. But if you do that, you have to make very clear your status. If you are signing on their behalf, you can't just scribble something on the back that looks kind of like your signature and kind of like their signature. You have to sign it in a way that makes clear what your function is. So you have to sign using the words, Joe client by Mary lawyer, or at least maybe include your initials or something, but just make abundantly clear on that endorsement that it is not their signature, that it is that you were the one physically signing it, that it was done with their authority. And the burden of proof is going to be on you to show that you had specific authority to sign that particular transaction. Well, then as promised, Rule 45.2 starts talking about the record-keeping requirements. And Rule 45.2 says that it pretty much says that any time that there is a transaction in your trust account, there has to be a contemporaneous notice given to the client. Anytime you make a withdrawal, the Iowa Court Commission, one of their documents said, when a lawyer withdraws funds from the trust account to pay fees or expenses, the client must be provided written notice of the time, amount, and purpose of the withdrawal. That has to be done no later than the day the withdrawal is made. So you have to transmit to your client a notice of any funds coming out of the trust account the same day. You can't wait and send them a statement at the end of the month. That's our first record-keeping requirement that we talk about. It's that any time you write a check from the trust account, The same day that you write that check from the trust account, some notice has to go to the client containing all of this information. Well, that means that how do you handle relatively small expenses? So, you know, you were hired to do the appeal for your client. And as a result of that appeal, you have to you print up the appellate briefs, or well, I guess now you probably do it electronically. But let's say you have to print up a bunch of documents and you have to mail them. So you have a $100 charge from the printing place and a $50 charge at the post office for the postage. To a certain extent, the easiest way to do that is just to take two checks from your trust account, write one out to the printer and write another one out to the post office to pay those expenses as they arise. And that still might be the easiest way for you to handle the transaction. But any time you do that, you have to remember that you have to make that notification the same day. So anytime you write a check from the trust account, you have to plan on sending a notice to the client the same day, which means that it might be easier in those cases when you have to write the check for $50 at the post office. It might actually be a lot less work for you if you just pay that $50 out of your pocket, out of the office account, and then include that in the monthly bill that you give the client. But that might actually wind up being easier. Well, rule 45.2 parentheses 3 talks about the records that have to be maintained. It does say here and in rule 1.15 that you have to retain these records for 6 years. And I'm not going to read through the full list here because Minnesota will have pretty much the same list. But basically, you have to save your bank statements, your check register, and the subsidiary of client check registers. You have to save them for 6 years. One other item, though, that you need to save for 6 years is copies of bills for legal fees and expenses rendered to clients. And that appears to be include not just trust account transactions, but all billing records. They need to be maintained for 6 years. So, I guess you're complying with that if you just, make a copy of the bill and stick it in the client file, and then it's there. But seems to me that if you're ever requested to get to show that to somebody as part of some kind of an audit, that's going to make your life very difficult going through every single client file for the past 6 years to pull out those bills. So it's probably a good idea to file those, or at least file a copy of those in a separate file along with all of your billing records, because if there ever is an audit, if you're ever requested to come up with those, that's going to be a lot of work digging them out for the past 6 years. So again, the better practice would probably be to keep those as a separate file, or at least to have a separate copy of all of your billing records. Now, the rules do make clear that these can be taken care of in electronic format. One thing I would watch out for there, if you are relying exclusively on electronic statements from your bank, I don't know if your bank has those going back 6 years. I don't know if those are still available to you. So if you are if you no longer get paper statements, and I'm kind of a Luddite when it comes to things like this, I wouldn't feel comfortable enough giving up my paper or bank statements and keeping them filed away. But if you do switch exclusively to electronic statements, or even you kind of figure you can shred all of your old trust account records because you have the electronic backup. Well, the copy that you have on the bank's online access, that might not go back 6 years. So if you are relying on those electronic records, you'll need to figure out some way to archive those yourself, because unless you can be absolutely certain that the bank will retain them for that long. So there are a lot of record-keeping requirements, and even though we have a full 3 hours to talk about this, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go into a lot of detail about this, other than that you have to keep good records and you have to keep copies of everything. And we will go into a little bit more detail about what is required in some of those specific records, like your trust account check register and your trust account subsidiary check registers. We'll talk about the contents of those. But for now, we'll just say that, yes, you have to have those and you have to save them for 6 years. And like I say, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later on. Now, another requirement about your trust account is who can sign the checks? Well, the answer is only a lawyer admitted to practice in this state or somebody under the direct supervision of that person. So the default provision is that only attorneys admitted in Iowa can sign Iowa trust account checks. The default provision is that you should not delegate that authority to your bookkeeper or your accountant, although it is permissible to delegate that. But if you delegate that signature authority to somebody other than an attorney, it has to be somebody under your direct supervision. And I don't think the words direct supervision are defined there exactly. Let's see, Rule 5.3 of the Rules of Professional Conduct is the rule that you should look at before you decide that you're going to let your secretary or an assistant or somebody have signature authority, because you are responsible for whatever that person does with respect to your account. So you want to use a lot of caution. You obviously want to have a competent, trustworthy person. And the Iowa Client Security Commission has a specific recommendation in that case where you have a non-attorney or perhaps even an attorney signing your trust account, that maybe you should consider having some kind of employee dishonesty insurance to cover that situation. Because it's, unfortunately, you hear about these cases of the trusted secretary or the trusted bookkeeper embezzling a lot of money. Well, you don't want that to happen to you. It's always that that trusted assistant who seems to do that. And unfortunately, you see articles about that happening on kind of a regular basis. So you do need to take that threat seriously, even if it is a trusted person, because the trusted person can get into financial difficulty, and if you leave that that avenue of temptation open to them, you might turn them into a person who is no longer as honest. So for their sake and for yours, it's a good thing to make sure that you have some pretty rigorous oversight of that person. Now, at a bare minimum, it seems to me that what I do, and this is kind of my rule anytime I deal with, dealing with somebody else's money, is that if you just have systems in place so that whoever is dealing with the money knows that some other party is going to see what's happening with the money, that can usually keep the honest people honest and will prevent the trusted bookkeeper from from becoming an embezzler. And the very minimum that what I suggest, and you know, when, and I always suggest this for you know, treasurers of nonprofits and so forth, is that yeah, you have one person writing the checks and making the deposits and so forth, but at the very minimum, you should have a second person opening the envelopes when they come from the bank with the bank statement. The trusted accountant is never allowed to do that step. So if you take that very minimal precaution, that is going to eliminate almost any possibility of dishonesty, or many of the possibilities of dishonesty, because those cases you see of the trusted bookkeeper turning into an embezzler, you know, they usually start out kind of, you know, the person is, you know, well, they're short on their car payment this month, and they just, you know, make, you know, this one little loan just this one time, and they put the money back. Well, they're tempted to do that if they think they can get away with it, but they will not be tempted to do that in the first place if they know that you, the attorney, are the one opening the bank statement on the trust account when it arrives from the bank every month. So just their knowledge of that is going to keep that sort of thing from happening. Now, will that prevent every kind of sophisticated embezzlement attempt? Well, no, obviously it won't, because if you if your bookkeeper is a sophisticated embezzler, you know, well, then that probably will not do it, because they'll be more sophisticated. But fortunately, most of the cases of employee dishonesty are not the result of sophisticated embezzlements. They are the result of somebody with temporary financial difficulties being tempted to resort to making loans to themselves, and unfortunately, quite often, gambling addictions. So if you open the trust account bank statement, even if you're not an accountant, even if you don't you know, understand how all this stuff works, well, at least you'll recognize that you knew that you didn't have any dealings with the auto dealership where your secretary had the loan. So when you see that check, you're going to realize something's weird. Or are you going to, if the person has a check, you know, made out to cash at the casino, you're going to realize that's not a problem. And if they know that there's no that those are going to be caught immediately, like I say, that's how you're going to keep that person honest. So you want to have a you are ultimately responsible for making sure that your trust account is accurate to the penny. You are the only person responsible for that. And you have that duty, but on the other hand, you know, you might have to delegate it. But when you do delegate it, you have to use a lot of caution. You need to have an honest, trustworthy person, a competent person doing that work for you, and you have to maintain a certain level of oversight to make sure that they remain honest. And at this point, I'm going to give our second code number, which is E-259, 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 E-259 is our next code number. So anyway, open those envelopes when they come from the bank, and just look through those canceled checks and make sure that there's nothing seriously wrong. And again, rule 5.3. Now, one question that comes up that does not have a clear answer, but I would err very much on the side of caution and say, no, you just shouldn't do it, is can you have a debit card for your trust account? For my personal checking account and for my business checking account, I have a debit card. I don't write very many checks anymore these days. So if I'm at the post office or the UPS store, paying for something for my business, or if I'm at the grocery store buying groceries, well, I don't write checks anymore. I get off the debit card and use that. And that's certainly become a great convenience for not only consumers and business people like us, but also for the banks. Makes the whole system run a lot more smoothly. But can you have a debit card for your trust account? Because I have to, I have to go pay the, I have to send out, 100 copies of this notice, I need to spend $49 at the post office to buy all the stamps. Well, it sure would be easier if I could just pull out my trust account debit card and use that. Is that possible? Well, I would say no. I would say just don't do it. And most of the attorneys I've talked to also say don't do it. And in fact, Wisconsin Rule 1.15 says don't do it. So if you are a Wisconsin attorney taking this program and your bank tries to put a debit card into your hands, you say no. That's against the law in Wisconsin. It's not permitted very specifically. Now, Iowa, on the other hand, and Minnesota, does not have a specific provision. The Iowa court rules and the Minnesota court rules don't say one way or another whether debit cards are permitted. In fact, I found one document here from the, I think it was from the Iowa Client Security Board, talking about the issue of, well, how do you pay filing fees now that we have e-filing for just about everything? It used to be you go to pay the filing fee, you would walk down to the courthouse, and you would bring your checkbook with you, and you would write a check to the clerk of court to cover the filing fee for this case that you're filing. Well, now with e-filing, they don't want to see your checkbook anymore. They want a credit card number on the court website. In fact, the Iowa attorneys have talked, I think in Minnesota, I think you have the option of using a bank account number, but in Iowa, apparently they want a credit card number. This document from the Iowa Client Security Board says, well, one option for handling that is to use a debit card from your trust account. And even though they say that's permissible, the Iowa attorneys I've talked to about that said, no, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And I don't feel comfortable about it either. But it's not specifically prohibited. And in fact, it seems to be allowed by that document. And that document, incidentally, right now is not accessible on the court website. I think my copy of the materials here, I have the 2015 version of it, but the Iowa court website just revamped all of its URLs, and that document seems to be missing. But I have a link to the 2012 version of it, which says the same thing. And I'm sure that that more recent version will be back when they get their website straightened out a little bit, because they just moved a bunch of stuff, and a lot of their links are broken. This just happened in the last couple of weeks, so it's nothing nefarious or anything. But that document did say, and that 2012 version says that, yep, you can use your trust account debit card for that transaction. But I would be very cautious about that. And if you do that, I have some cautions I recommend. First of all, even though you're on the court website and you punch in the debit card number and that transaction is done in 2 minutes, well, remember though, that is a withdrawal from the trust account, so that triggers that requirement that you have to send the notice to your client that same day. So even though you're engaging in this simple online transaction, you have to make that notification to the client, and that has to be done the same day. Now, be very, very careful with that debit card. And I would not keep that in my wallet. I would keep that locked up somewhere at my office, because it's just too risky walking around with the thing. Because for one thing, it probably looks identical to the other debit card that you have in your pocket. For your personal account, because you probably have the trust account at the same bank. So, you know, if you have your bank account with the Farmers National Bank, and they send you two debit cards, or maybe you have three accounts there, you know, one for your personal account, one for your business account, and one for your trust account. Well, they all look identical. So what I would do, first of all, make sure it has the words trust account embossed on it, because as we noted above, it has to say that clearly. But I would get out a Sharpie and write across the face of the card, trust account, so that there's no possibility that I can get it mixed up. Because if I go down to the 7-Eleven to buy a cup of coffee and hand them my debit card, I don't want to accidentally give them the trust account one. Because that's a serious violation of me stealing my client's money, even though it's inadvertent. So don't carry it with you, but probably have it clearly marked that it belongs to the trust account, so that there's no possibility that you can get it mixed up. And also, one thing, if you do have that debit card, I would strongly recommend contacting the bank to make sure that ATM access is disabled for that card, because I think was the rule we just quoted, or one of these rules, says that money can be taken out of the trust account with a check or an authorized electronic transfer, but it goes on to say very, very specifically that in no event shall you ever, ever, ever make a cash withdrawal from your trust account. So even if you can think of some legitimate reason why you would need to do that, the client has the bail money in your trust account, and the bail has to be paid in cash, the rules specifically say that no, you cannot go to the bank and make a cash withdrawal from your trust account. So you really, you can never make a cash withdrawal from the trust account. So I would, to keep from doing that inadvertently, I would probably make sure that ATM access is disabled. I'm just going to talk really quickly, because we're almost up to the clock right now, about where can you have your trust account. This is a very long rule, but there's some out-of-date language in there. We'll talk about it a little bit more tomorrow, because we do need to talk about federal insurance. Basically, it has to be in a federally insured bank, savings bank, trust company, savings and loan association, savings association, credit union, or federally regulated investment company. So it has to be in a real bank. You can't have your trust account with PayPal, because PayPal is not a bank. So that would not meet the requirement. But I think you can be relatively assured that if it says bank on the door, they are a bank. At this point, I heard one person leave, so I'm going to give the that final code number right now of E275, E275, E275 is the final code number. And then I will just, in our remaining 1 minute, say that don't worry about the convoluted language in this rule talking about credit unions. Because credit unions used to have slightly different rules regarding limits of insurance, and those rules have changed. So even though there are several paragraphs in the rule talking specifically about credit unions have to comply with these special requirements, you don't have to worry about that quite so much anymore because now the same rules apply federally for both banks and credit unions. Okay, so again, that that final code number for the program was E275. I'm just going to check quickly again here for any questions, and I see there is one here. Let me okay, there the case I mentioned yesterday of the Minnesota attorney. I guess maybe there was a little bit more to that case than I perhaps mentioned yesterday. So maybe that 2 years was warranted for some other reasons. But anyway, I see that was the only question. I'm going to just quickly open the. Let's see if I can find it here on my computer. I'm going to unmute, and I will just pause for any final questions. Okay. Well, hearing none, I'm going to just end the recording here, and we'll pick this up on part 3.